Welcome to Wheelchair Nerds, a podcast intended to connect and inform people who utilize, prescribe, and provide seating and wheeled mobility equipment. I'm your host, Angie Kiger. All right, wheelchair nerds, welcome back. It is time for another episode. It has been a few weeks since we've recorded Wheelchair Nerds podcast episodes because we were at the International Seating Symposium. Now we are back and super excited for actually our next series that we're recording. When we think about different products, we think about different wheelchairs, especially power wheelchairs, and what sort of power seating functions folks can get on power wheelchairs. One of the ones that we get questioned about the most from not only individuals who are looking to get a new wheelchair, but also clinicians and providers, and honestly, payer sources, always ask a lot of questions about standing. What is a standing feature? Why would somebody need standing on a power wheelchair? What are the benefits? And is it hard to get if someone hasn't stood independently in X number of months or years? Is standing still potentially appropriate for them? And we're going to try to get into various things. As we know, when it comes to this podcast, we are not providing any medical advice. We always recommend that folks go talk with your clinicians and make sure you are trained and feel confident in this. Really and truly, we want to, with a standing series, just to really introduce standing to folks who've never considered power standing before, talk about the applications of it. We're also, in a couple of episodes, we're probably going to be touching on the research, what the evidence says, and talk about what options are out there when it comes to the type of drive wheel base. So on today's podcast, our first in the standing series, we've got Danielle joining us from Wisconsin. She utilizes a power wheelchair, has for a number of years. I'll let her get into her whole history, introduce herself and whatnot. But we're excited for her to tell her story because she actually got a new power wheelchair at the end of last year. It was quite the journey from what she's already shared with me in the beginning. But before we jump into that long and arduous process, we'll say, Danielle, tell me a little bit about you. Let's start with, why do you utilize a power wheelchair? I don't want to say medical history because that sounds too like we're at you can tell my wheelchair clinical evaluation brain is on because I'm like, so tell me your medical history. You know, share as much as you would like, Danielle, about yourself.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Danielle DeSantio. I was born with cerebral palsy. So I started off the majority of my life using a manual chair, actually. And it wasn't until high school that I started using a power chair. The standing chair really came as an importance to me when I became independent and moved out of my parents' home. Because I needed the ability to stand independently, which is kind of what the standing chair did for me, rather than using a standing frame where someone would have to transfer me in and out of the standing frame. So that's kind of what brought me to the standing chair. And really kind of meeting with my doctor and talking about my personal goals as far as my health and kind of my independence. Just the ability to wait there over time without needing the assistance of someone else, as well as other benefits such as, you know, GI and like stomach issues and bladder function and things like that. So that's kind of my health history, I guess.
Very good. Let's talk a little bit about, so you said a few things that are interesting, and it's hard to paint that picture on a podcast, if you will. So let's talk about young Danielle a bit. Okay, so you're in, you said like middle school, high schoolish time frame. This is something that a lot of my friends who have cerebral palsy, and I think I've disclosed to you, I worked in pediatric for a number of years prior to joining a wheelchair manufacturer. And I remember I used to see a lot of kiddos who were headed to high school or to college that had historically propelled themselves in a manual wheelchair that had cerebral palsy. And they hit this dilemma of like, do I move to a power wheelchair? So how did you decide, how did your family decide that, hey, you know, I think it's time, Danielle, for you to consider power? Was that your idea, a clinician's idea, parents?
No, I hated the idea of a power chair because my manual chair was kind of my way to exercise and have some catharsis in my day. So the power chair really came into play when I got into high school. My high school had two buildings we had to go between for classes, so that really meant that I had to be on time, and as we all know, sometimes propelling yourself in front of, you know, 50,000 students trying to get to one place. So that's kind of where the power chair came into play. So it was both the therapist and my parents kind of made that overall decision, but I was actually totally against it. So I got my first power chair at 14.
So you got your first power chair at 14. In reality, how long was it before you said, oh, maybe my therapist and my parents were right, that it was a good idea?
Well, I was a pretty stubborn teenager.
You were a teenager, so.
I would say probably about 16 is when I really started to realize that maybe it was something I needed more day to day, and I could use the manual chair kind of as a backup, or, you know, if I still wanted to do some exercise, but maybe not getting from point A to point B on a regular basis.
Gotcha. Makes sense. Okay. So Danielle's 16. She says, okay, the power wheelchair, it's working out. I think it makes sense. And then where did you go to undergrad? I know we talked a little bit about prior in our pre-interview that you've kind of been in the Wisconsin, Chicago area most of your life. So where did you decide to go to undergrad and what'd you get your degree in?
So that's kind of a journey. I started out at Southern Illinois University. My whole goal was to move as far away from home as possible. And so I did for my first semester, and I hated it down there. I didn't have the support networks that I had up where I grew up, and so I decided to come back. I took the rest of the semester off and then followed up with my undergrad at UW-Whitewater, and then I graduated from there in 2012.
Gotcha. And then you were saying you went on to grad school, because correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you have your master's in social work. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And then where did you do grad school?
I did grad school at Loyola University of Chicago.
Okay. So we were joking earlier about geography's not my strong suit. So is Loyola like in the thick of things in the city, or is it more on the outskirts of Chicago?
So they have a program for undergrad that's kind of on the outskirts. But my program was inner city, downtown, hustle and bustle everywhere.
Nice.
Yes. So that's where Pop really came in handy, because I don't think I would have made it between classes.
Makes sense. Okay, so do you consider yourself more of a city gal, or are you more of a suburbs gal? Like, where are you at these days?
Oh, I'm definitely a city gal. I love my suburbs for, like, the small diners that you can't really find in the city. But just as far as transit and everything goes, the city obviously, you know, presents more opportunity to move around. Mm-hmm. And I'm a pretty active person, despite my physical limitations.
So. Gotcha. All right, you're super active. What do you like to do on the weekends? I know you've got a pretty, once before we talked, you're talking about your friend group. You like to go out with folks, and, you know, what are some of your favorite things to do?
So I love bowling.
Nice.
And shopping, and I actually am a big theater nerd.
Nice.
Theater most of high school, actually all 4 years. I was going to actually major in it in college and then decided against it. So, yeah, those are kind of my activities on the weekends. But I do work full-time, so that keeps me kind of busy in the meantime.
So. Yes. So how are you using that social work degree that you work so hard for?
Oh, boy. Well, currently I'm a care coordinator through our Wisconsin Medicaid program. And we are now part of Humana, but when I started, we were independent care health plan, just a tiny HMO. So now I work for, everyone calls it iNana, but it's iCare Humana. We're still iCare. So we service many different counties in Wisconsin, northern, southeastern, southwestern. So I have a caseload of about 250 members at this time. I'm pretty active, pretty busy, but I love what I do.
250 members. I think some therapists listening to this might be thinking they've got a large caseload. I know sometimes my friends that work in school systems will say that they have very large caseloads because they're going around from school to school. But I think 250 is the largest caseload I've ever heard of anybody in the allied health professionals telling me that they have had.
Yeah, they're pretty busy. I mean, part of my job is kind of seeing where members fall. So some members might have a higher acuity level, meaning they need more kind of coordination with providers, DME companies, dermal medical companies, things like that. Some I might do an assessment with them once a year and never speak to them again. So it kind of just depends on what the member needs. And as we all know in healthcare, that can change at any given time. So
very true. So, kind of jumping back into how we got connected, I think it's important for folks to know, you know, this is the beauty of, we talk about with Wheelchair Nerds is, you know, our goal really is to connect folks who utilize, prescribe, and recommend power wheelchairs and provide them, not just power wheelchairs, but really any sort of complex rehab technology. And that's the reason why we started the podcast. So I'm hoping through this podcast, you know, we'll be able to meet all sorts of really cool people. And let's say a few months ago, one of my coworkers reached out to me, Ashley. Ashley Detterbeck, shout out if you're listening. Ashley is a clinical educator for ProMobile, PT, and very passionate physical therapist by background, I should say educational background, and very passionate about standing, has done some research with some other colleagues when it comes to standing. And I think a lot of times, especially in your part of the country, Danielle, when people think standing and think of clinicians, Ashley's one of the first to pop in their head because she's really been a huge advocate for standing. And so she reached out to me because she's in Wisconsin. I know you guys haven't met in person, but somebody you have met in person from ProMobile by the name of Lori. She's your local, what we call internally, territory sales manager. So she covers that area with support, the clinic that you went to get your power chair. They reached out and were like, hey, you know, we've met Danielle. She just got a new power wheelchair, standing power wheelchair, and is really interested in doing more for advocacy and awareness for power standing. First of all, were my colleagues accurate with that or not?
That's correct.
That's correct. So, okay. With that said, as someone who utilizes a power wheelchair and you got the standing feature, why did you see that it was necessary to say, hey, like, I need to speak up about this?
From a personal and professional side, I kind of saw the need to advocate more, to put my voice out there. Because I work heavily with the Medicaid population, I kind of see the pieces of equipment that are pretty regularly denied by us. And so it really kind of painted a different picture for me that maybe I wasn't the only one struggling with certain aspects of medical equipment. And that's when I realized maybe I need to speak up as well, because I would say about a fourth of my caseload is, you know, ongoingly dealing with different issues related to DME. And so it's kind of was an eye-opener for me professionally. And then, of course, obviously, personally, I had my own struggles trying to get the standing chair covered. So there's a little bit of a twofold there.
Nice. Well, number one, thank you for standing up, you know, in doing advocacy, standing up with your power wheelchair, but then also just kind of stepping forward is probably the better way to say that. You know, as someone, and I think some folks know my story who listen to the podcast, some don't. I have a first cousin. I only have four first cousins, which oftentimes baffles people, I guess, because my mom was an only child and my dad only had two siblings. I only have four first cousins. But anyway, one of my four first cousins has CP. And so, you know, I talk a lot about the different difficulties back in the 80s and 90s that I watched as my aunt and uncle navigated for Susan. And, you know, even today, Susan clearly is an adult at this point in her life. That was back in the 80s and 90s. And it was just some of her, she doesn't utilize a wheelchair, but just her other equipment needs that she needed and kind of what she navigated there. And I think it's interesting because I didn't truly become, I won't say wrapped up, but I would say passionate about advocacy until maybe 10 years ago. And some of it was seeing friends, clients. I mean, some of the denials that we would receive were laughable, and that sounds terrible. We're not speaking about, we're not talking about any negative as far as our Medicare, Medicaid systems go, but I'll never forget we were recommending a manual wheelchair, a tilt and space wheelchair for a little girl who has CP. I remember we were like, oh, good, her wheelchair frame got approved, but the seating system didn't. Mm-hmm. So we're like, okay, so she's got a manual wheelchair frame, but no seating system approved. And that was one of our first like eye-opening experience at our clinic to be like, this advocacy thing is going to be something we need to do more of, right? Like we need to help families, because I can't even imagine what a family, you know, what that experience would be, because here is this child's mom going, we know she needs a wheelchair. I can't physically carry her places. Mm-hmm. And if she doesn't have a seating system on it, this doesn't make much sense. But on the flip mm-hmm. side of that, we are in a little bit of our bubble, and I'm interested to hear your opinion on this, Danielle. When it comes to complex rehab technology, is that if you've either grown up like I have, of having a family member that has disabilities, and I've seen her friends and her network utilize various types of equipment, and then you move into folks who have never been exposed to equipment, and maybe they happen to have a job working at a place where they have the capability to approve or deny equipment, they're not doing it to be vindictive. You know, they're not saying this person doesn't need the equipment, but it's a matter of knowledge, I think. I don't know. What do you think about that, Danielle?
Well, I think I've seen actually my denial for my power standing multiple times. And so I think sometimes when you don't see the face behind the name or the physical limitation behind the name, but you see that black and white, it's very easy to say, well, this doesn't fit the ICD code, so I'm not going to approve it. And it's a challenge that I'm not sure how we need to overcome this in the future, but I think working together between individuals like myself that kind of deal with this day-to-day, that have that knowledge, that can push for it. And I think I said to you a while ago, but I said, say no to the no.
Yes, say no to the no's. Yes, that should be the name of this podcast.
I mean, I think that's really important. However, you know, if it wasn't for my support system to say, hey, Danielle, keep pushing, I might have given up in round two and said, just give me what they'll pay for and call it a day. And something that I really struggle as a person with a disability needing equipment is that a lot of times Medicaid will say, okay, we'll cover this part, but we won't cover this, but we're not going to let you pay your wheelchair supplier the part that we're not covering, because that's against Medicaid rules. So then you kind of are in this all-or-nothing phase, right, where it's like, well, this was denied. I can't cover the standing part that was denied, and Medicaid's not going to cover it, so now where do I go? You know, and I think that's a big struggle, I think, that the Medicaid system as a whole, I'm so grateful for the benefit that we do have, but I think we need to, you know, shine a bigger light on what that looks like for someone's day-to-day activities. Because you don't see that. You see a piece of paper, you see black and white, you know, numbers and letters and kind of this diagnosis, well, cerebral palsy, and, you know, she doesn't fit into this box, so we're not going to pursue this. And so it's kind of, you know, it's a struggle.
You know, I think that it's important to say that as we're recording this in April of 2023, this is something that various groups are working on. We've actually, at the end of last year, really started to get some movement. We were hoping initially. So for folks who are listening and might not understand, this is specifically for the funding system in the United States. So there's something called the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and they really determine, you know, what is considered to be medically necessary, and they assign a fee schedule to it. So basically how much they'll reimburse if someone has these two programs as their payer source. You know, why CMS has so much power, because some folks listening to this might say, oh, I actually am, I don't have Medicaid as a backup. I don't qualify for XYZ reasons, or I'm not on Medicare. This doesn't apply to me. It actually does, because you'll find that most of the other third-party payers that are, you may receive insurance through your job, and so you don't qualify for Medicaid, whatever, they actually go by CMS. They look towards CMS as kind of the standard, right? So that's where they look at to say, oh, should we pay for something? Should we not pay for something? And so it does actually, it's really impactful for CMS to say yes to paying for something. And so at the end of last year, we received word back. And when I say we, it's a whole group of stakeholders and had gotten together. There are individuals who utilize wheelchairs. There are individual advocates. You've got a lot of advocacy groups, organizations like the Reeve Foundation, various other ones. There's no way I can name them all. There's a group that was formed called the ITEM Coalition, really joining together also wheelchair manufacturers such as Permobile. Wheelchair providers were coming together. And it was like, okay, we need to get this message to CMS. And so we were super excited because we heard back, because we had submitted for, hey, power seat elevate and power standing, they are medically necessary. We had just a plethora of research, and we had individuals who utilize this technology explaining it. We had, medical professionals saying why, and it came back, and we kind of are excited now in April, but a little bit of a letdown. And what I mean by that is Elevate was actually something that they said, okay, we can get with you on Power Seat Elevate. We see that could be medically necessary. That is, that's the direction we want to move. But somehow standing was pushed to the side. It was definitely a huge bummer for a lot of folks who were pursuing power standing, who prescribe power standing, and who manufacture it. We're like, oh man, like this great innovative technology. Yes, we're excited about Elevate. Don't get us wrong. We're super excited about that. But hey, what about standing? So
the interesting part for me, actually, when I got the denial for Medicaid was that they didn't deny the standing. They denied the stand and drive. But as you know, with Permobile, there is no standing without driving. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same component, right? Mm-hmm. They said, okay, well, we'll pay for your standing, but we're not going to pay for the stand and drive component.
Which is interesting. So, okay. All right. So let's pause right there. So I believe you had mentioned that you've had power chairs in the past and you've had kind of separate static standing devices. What does it take to get you in a stander?
It takes a caregiver, family, someone who can kind of just sit there while I'm standing and get me out when I'm done. And so mm-hmm. that could, and my biggest argument to that is, okay, well, you're trying to reduce caregiver hours. Well, you're actually going to add more on because now not only do they have to do my personal cares day to day, but they also have to stand there while I'm standing. And mm-hmm. so that adds a bit more time, whereas with the standing chair, I can just do it on my own. I don't need somebody standing here to watch me do that.
And just so people understand, when you are, throughout the day-to-day, you're not with somebody 24 hours a day, are you?
I'm not. Nope. I have someone in the morning to get me ready for work, and then midday to help with lunch tasks, and then in the evening, dinner through bed. But I work 8 hours a day, so they're not with me when I'm working. And so that's why the standing chair was really important, especially, for someone that deals with not only the physical fatigue, but also the mental fatigue of working an 8-hour day. It's a strain that can't really describe unless you do it.
True.
And I love what I do. It's just sometimes I have to back away and, stand or change position. And so if I wasn't able to do that in my chair, I wouldn't be able to probably do that until somebody was able to come here and do it for me.
So let's talk a little bit about when, and it was kind of for perspective, correct me if I'm wrong, but the chair that you are in now, that was delivered in the fall of last year, right? In 2022?
Correct.
Okay, so was that your first power standing chair?
No, I had one previous to this one, which actually I had trouble with insurance as well. So I had a private funding source that covered the portion that insurance wouldn't cover. So I was very grateful for that. And actually, this standing chair, the Permobile Foundation covered a portion of it that wasn't covered by insurance. I was very grateful for that as well.
Gotcha. And I think a lot of people don't know that there are some resources out there, such as the Permobile Foundation, that can assist with that. Obviously, can't make up for the massive gap of everybody, but definitely, is something to look into or to pursue alternative funding. But, we really are looking at, some of the things that you were stating was that standing on a power wheelchair helps you to be able to change your position during the day, which is, good gracious, important for bone health, bone density over time, being able just to stand up and weight bear, just to move your position because, what if your, shoulders start to get tired, your head, whatever, wherever you're feeling fatigued, if you just want to get up and move. I mean, I don't utilize any complex rehab technology myself. So I think about, selfishly, I can't relate, honestly, Danielle, if my butt starts to hurt and I want to get up, I'm able to get up. So it's like, the power standing feature in your power chair and combined with the other features on your power chair allow you what a lot of people, you know, it would say like the luxury, but it's like allows you the ability. It's not the luxury, the ability to do what people without disabilities can do.
And I think that the biggest question with CMS is, okay, well, she has a tilt function. Mm-hmm. But what tilt doesn't do that the standing does is that I feel that stretch in my tendon that mm-hmm. I'm not going to get tilt, right? So the mm-hmm. tilt's going to offload my weight on my butt and my back, you know, things like that. But it's not going to stretch me like standing would do. Mm-hmm. And that's where I really noticed a big difference just with overall fatigue is the ability to kind of, you know, stretch my hip flexors, my hamstrings, every part of CP that we all hate. So, but it really has proven a difference for me over time. Even if it's, you know, an hour and a half after work, I'm just kind of watching TV and I want to just change my position, I want to stretch. You know, now I don't need someone doing those passive range of motion so much anymore. Is I can kind of do that on my own.
And the other thing, most people with disabilities aren't afraid to talk about it. Like, many of my friends are like, this is a real part of our life. But stuff that people without disabilities are like, oh, are we going to talk about that? But you talk about, like, your bowel program, you know, being able to have your GI system work appropriately, bowel and bladder is huge, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It always makes me laugh. People are always embarrassed to talk about that. I'm like, hey, that is an internal function.
Definitely. I mean, I think bowel and bladder function has always been a topic of conversation for those of us with CP and, you know, the neurogenic bladder. And so it's kind of trying to compensate for those, you know, deficits, I guess, is the best way to say it. But I noticed a big difference. And because my GI system is better functioning, I'm not going to say it's 100%, but I've noticed an overall difference in my bladder function as well. And so that really plays a role when you're dependent on someone for your day-to-day activities. So
for sure. What about functional activities? You know, you and I've never met in person, so I'm full disclosure to our audience. I'm not sure as far as like your upper extremities and that sort of stuff. Are you able to use a standing feature to go and grab things in the kitchen or help you with laundry or any sort of other activities of daily living?
Yeah, so my apartment is on the older side. It was built in the 80s, and so there's part of it that's accessible and then part of it that's not. A big function that I'm able to do with the standing chair is that I'm able to reach the thermostat, which sounds funny to everybody, but sometimes you don't want your house at the same temperature for 8 hours until someone comes back. It's things like that. It's, you know, helping caregivers with laundry. Sometimes even at the stove, you know, I'll help a caregiver even to wash dishes because my sink is not at the right height for me. It's not to say that they didn't try, but as we all know, things kind of vary from individual to individual. So yeah, different tasks around the house, definitely I can be more, you know, successful, and I'm just grateful. I know a couple of my cabinets are too high, and so I'm able to kind of reach those as needed.
Nice. Very cool. I want to, I know we bounced around a bit because we keep talking about this chair that was delivered in fall, and I want to make sure that we really touch on that because somebody who might be listening to this might think to themselves, hey, I want to recommend a power wheelchair for one of my clients, or I want to, or somebody who has never tried a power standing wheelchair might be thinking, oh, hey, this might be appropriate for me or for my loved one. What was the process that you had to go through as someone who's seeking power standing feature? Like, walk me back through, like, when did the process start for this power chair that you had and what did it entail?
Oh, boy. Well, it started with the doctor visit. And because I had one already, you know, he was able to kind of justify based on what I needed before. And then I have employer insurance, I have Medicare, and I have Medicaid. So I have a trifecta. which may seem like it's great, but they each have their barriers and complications to things. And so
I want to interrupt you really quick. Do you remember when you went for that doctor's visit or contacted your doctor, like ballpark?
I had my first visit in July of 21.
Okay, wow. Okay. All right. Yeah. I think it's important for telling the accurate story. I think it's important that people hear like how long this process. So July of 2021, you go to your doctor, you say, hey, Dr. So-and-so, it's time for me to get a new power wheelchair. I need a referral. I need a script to go to a wheelchair clinic. Was that right?
Yes. So the clinic that I went to was, it's kind of all inclusive. So the doctors was there and then the clinic was also in the same building. So I could kind of just go down there. And their process is that they have PTs and OTs that do the evaluation on site. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I went through just to find out what cushion would work. And as someone that is kind of more on her own and not having that support, maybe a mom or dad or sister, you know, taking me out of my chair, I really needed something that was better functioning for me overall when I'm in my chair, you know, 16, 17 hours a day, which is most days. So
you went for, had a doctor's referral, evaluation with OTs and PTs, one or the other, could have been in this clinic setting. And then I'm guessing the wheelchair provider came into the picture at some point too?
Correct. Yes. So the wheelchair provider was present, I believe, through all my meetings with the OT, just going off what I had before and what worked and what didn't work. Because there was something that didn't work for me, and that was the cushion. I decided that I need a little bit more gel support just overall. We changed that out from the last order, but everything pretty much was the same from there. From that end, after that first initial appointment, then came the letter of medical necessity, and I'm sure everyone listening might know what that is. And then that was all submitted in a nice, lovely package to all of my insurances.
So that was July 2021 is when it started. Any idea of when that LMN and order and all kind of, or quote, usually letter of medical necessity plus the quote from the provider normally go at the same time. Any idea when that was submitted?
Oh, boy. I want to say it might have been I went in July, so it was probably like 3 months, September, maybe?
Okay. Of 2021?
Yep.
Okay.
As I came to find out, the wheelchair provider did not have the correct insurance for me. Mm. And in November... Mm-hmm. I get a message from them saying, hey, you have an HMO, which I don't know if anyone knows out here that's listening. An HMO is a Medicaid program through a state. It stands for Health Maintenance Organization. And we know that because I've worked for one. they said, hey, you have an HMO. You need a primary care referral. And I said, that's interesting because I don't have an HMO. It took like 5 or 6 phone calls, maybe 6 or 7 meltdowns of me calling Humana saying, what's your prior authorization fax number? I need this because my wheelchair supplier is not submitting to the right insurance. Then it was faxed to them. Of course, they had to make their decision. And anyone in the insurance world knows that there's your primary level of insurance, there's secondary, and then there's tertiary when you have a third-party insurance. For me, my tertiary was Medicaid, so that was always the payer of last resort. Well, Humana came back and said, well, we're not going to cover the standing chair. We'll cover the... They didn't cover the seat elevate, I don't think, either. Pretty much everything else on the chair was covered. But then it went to Medicare. Medicare upheld that decision. Then it went to Medicaid. I think I had to appeal it twice after that first initial and was still getting in denial from Medicare and Medicaid and Humana as well. And so that's when I almost threw in the towel, but then the wheelchair supplier said, you know what, try the ProMobile Foundation. They've helped people in the past. Maybe you might be eligible for it. And so I did. And I basically talked about my work environment and how it was really important for me to be able to talk to colleagues at eye level beyond, you know, just my day-to-day activities, but kind of that outside, you know, go out to lunch with a colleague, you want to talk to them, you know, at eye level, which is really important. I found out actually at the same time that my waiver program covered a portion of it through Wisconsin. It's a Medicaid waiver. Mm-hmm. And the automobile covered the rest of it. So I owed pretty much nothing on the chair except the cup holder of it. That all came about like a year and a half later. It was when it was like, okay, stuff is finally starting to move. My, you know, wheelchair rep through my provider, he and I have known each other since I was probably about 9 years old. He's seen a lot of chairs come and go. And I had said to him at one point, I said, you know what, I'm just, whatever they're going to cover, they're going to cover. And he's like, no, you need to keep fighting for it. You need to keep fighting for it. And he was a big support. He actually wrote a letter himself to Medicaid, besides the letter of medical necessity. So, and then I wrote my own personal letter to them as well. I don't think it made much of a difference, but I'm hoping that if more people kind of hear my story and they do it over and over, people will start to see how important it really is.
It's interesting that you say that. One of my mentors within the advocacy and government relations world, I've known her for, gosh, it's 2012. She's a good friend of mine out of North Carolina. And I remember when we would sometimes do clinical education events together, and we would talk about this with folks. And some people would say, well, we know it's not going to get paid for. Why even like put the person who's going to be using the chair through this? Because it's just going to get denied. Like that's just, and it all came back to, you know, for clinicians out there, I will tell you, you know, it goes based on what is medically necessary. So if it is deemed something that is medically necessary for someone, yeah, you know, your standards of practice should say you've still got to put it, you have to put it in there as like saying it's medically necessary. The key is, of course, to have that conversation and be very open and say, you know what, this is what we know is medically necessary and here's why it's medically necessary. We're all, meaning clinician, provider, family, end user, whomever it is, we're all going to join together and fight this battle because everyone has to be on the same page with it. But back to what I was saying with my friend who is the funding expert, she said, that's the thing is that so many people would just be like, well, it's not going to get covered. So either, you know, so we're not even going to bother to fight for it. So it's like, no, it's kind of like, you know, when you're younger, she gave this example. She's like, it's like when you're a kid and your mom tells you no. Do you take that as a no, or do you go to your dad or go to your grandmother or go to whomever? It's like, hey, like you kind of be that squeaky wheel. I can't imagine how stressful and frustrating and, you know, aggravating it was for you to go through this process. I am also hopeful, like you are, that if more people come forward and say, hey, this is my story, this is what I went through, not to say that, hey, everybody should have to do this, but it's like maybe if they're hearing that more people are doing this and they're going to fight because it is medically necessary, it is functionally necessary for their, you know, for their life to be independent, then we'll be able to make some changes. You know, I will say that we are very hopeful in less than a month. As I said, we're recording this here in towards the end of April of 2023 that we'll have a firm decision on Elevate in mid-May. And as soon as that happens, the advocacy groups throughout the country are moving right over to standing. It's like, okay, you didn't want to talk about it before. We got to Elevate. Now we're switching to standing.
Yeah. And I think sometimes it's hearing what in the know that's important. Mm-hmm. Not just hearing the no, but why is this a no? And, you know, how can we advocate to make those changes to say, okay, well, I hear you, but here's my side of the story. Mm-hmm. You know, here's me as a whole individual, not just a diagnosis, mm-hmm. not just ICD code from the insurance standpoint, but here's me as a person. I work 40 hours a week. You know, I have friends, I have family. I live completely out of state from my family. Most of my support is of natural support or paid caregivers that maybe a year and a half ago, I had no idea they even existed on the planet. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of just the idea that if we all sit down and say, okay, well, we're not going to do this, well, then, no, we're not going to enlighten anybody to what really needs to change out there. I mean, there were days where I had to step back and say, I can't do this wheelchair stuff today. I have to do something else. And part of that, too, was so much of my job day-to-day is dealing with DME providers, clinicians. And so when I had to take my lunch break to fight for my own chair, it brought me to tears. Taking that step back, especially for families, you know, that are the sole caregivers for somebody with a disability, and just saying, okay, well, maybe we're going to table this today because we have too many appointments to do, but tomorrow we're going to pick back up at it and do it again. And just kind of keeping that in mind. It's not an overnight process. It's not going to happen with a snap of a finger, but if we kind of just take a step back and really say to ourselves, okay, well, this is why we're doing this, and this is why it needs to happen.
For sure. It is a journey. It's a process, but I'm so glad that you, for not only for yourself, but you fought for it, but then also, as you said, like adding to the number of cases that are out there saying, yes, it is important. I'm going to fight for this. And then also being, you know, open and stepping forward and saying, hey, I want to talk about this more. Cause I think you're right. I think a lot of families, a lot of individuals, they just give up. It's like, it's just too hard. Like, it's just, I know I need this. I know medically I need this, but I can't keep going to bat for this. And there are groups out there that are communities of folks. Unite for CRT is one of them. They're actually a group that is of individuals who utilize wheelchairs primarily, or complex rehab technology primarily. But it is actually kind of a offshoot, if you will, of the National Registry of Rehabilitation Technology Suppliers. NARTS is the acronym. But it's an offshoot of the providers of complex rehab. And they've gotten together and they have a group of end users and clinicians that work on advocacy. So there are other folks out there. I think it's important that we continue to tell those stories. And Danielle, thank you so much for being on our podcast. I'm sure we're going to have you continue to tell your stories in other ways, especially once we start this full on, like, advocate for more. That's Permobil's landing page from our website, Advocate for More. That's where we put the most up-to-date information. You know, no matter what brand of equipment that folks utilize, we want them to know we are advocating. You know, we are a wheelchair manufacturer that innovates and believes in what we do and what we're innovating for and who we're innovating for. And we just have to make sure people can have access to all this great technology.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that's a wrap, guys. And remember, just as a quick reminder that anything we talked about here was specifically related to the wheelchair provision process, the evaluation process, working with a provider. This was all Danielle's experience. This is not any sort of medical or clinical advice. Definitely reach out to your own clinical providers if you are seeking this, to make sure that whatever piece of equipment you end up with is the one that is right for you. Thanks so much, guys. Don't forget to share this podcast with your friends. Subscribe to Wheelchair Nerds. There's more coming. This was just our first in our series of talking about power standing. Thank you for listening to Wheelchair Nerds, presented by Permobil. Today's episode was brought to you by...
The future of power wheelchairs is here. Introducing the Permobil F5 Corpus VS. It combines the performance features of the F5 Corpus with superior power standing functionality. Leverage fully programmable standing sequences using a combination of supine, semi-reclined, or sit-to-stand techniques. You can even fine-tune standing positions with adjustable chest support, moldable knee supports, and power articulating foot plates. And now, the F5 Corpus is available with Group 3 and Group 4 base codes, making it more accessible than ever to pursue power standing. Stand without compromise with the F5 Corpus VS.
So happy you joined us today. If you like what you heard, then be sure to subscribe and tell your nerdy friends. Have a topic you want discussed or know a great guest? Hit us up at Wheelchair Nerds on Instagram. See y'all in the next one.